after the first travel ban issued by the Trump administration went into effect. Now, I wasn't personally worried, of course. I'm a middle-aged white lady with an American passport. My husband, however, for the past 40 years, is a legal alien. I'm married to an alien. He's a Canadian citizen with a green card. Now, to be honest, I knew that the Houston immigration officials were unlikely to detain him, but I worried. Nevertheless, I mean, what did they have on him? Did they know that he was a left-wing radical hippie type in the 60s? That he was an outspoken opponent of the death penalty, gun control, war on drugs, victimization of people living with HIV/AIDS, and participated in more than one Black Lives Matter rally? And if they wanted to dig deeper, they would surely discover his numerous traffic tickets over the past 5 years. Mostly speeding to church, I would tell them. And certainly they would know about his involvement with the Unitarian Universalist Association, which would look suspicious. And I wondered if he were a brown-skinned Latino Canadian citizen resident alien instead of a very white-skinned Icelandic Canadian guy, would he have been waved through as easily as he was? But instead, would he have been stopped, questioned, perhaps taken into a private room, had his luggage searched, subject to a drug-sniffing dog, and detained for an indefinite period of time? Well, we had to go to two lines, one for those with United States passport and those with other foreigners, and there was a little bit of time. I didn't know what was happening to him. What if he got delayed? What if we missed our connecting flight? And I lived for a few moments, paranoid moments, with those nagging fears. Well, of course, you can guess the end of the story. We breezed through the Houston airport, all the while watching the news unfold of people being detained at airports, of lawyers rushing to the airports to assist them, of people bringing coffee and donuts and food to stranded men, women, and children on both sides of the border who had the wrong passport from a banned country that day. I felt disoriented and confused, and I asked myself, what country am I living in? Maybe you've been asking yourself that same question lately. This morning, I want to take a look at the problem of immigration that we're facing right now, both as a nation and here in Wisconsin. And this look has to include what faith communities are or are not doing in response to the growing crisis. And in the end, I'm going to represent our executive team in proposing that this congregation vote to become a recognized sanctuary congregation here in the Fox Valley. But before we get there, we need to look together first at the nature of the problem and why we have it. And in researching this sermon, I found myself it was easy to get overwhelmed by the statistics we hear about undocumented immigrants living and working in the United States. But here are some reliable facts. Today, this country has 11.4 million undocumented workers, more than half of them living in California, Texas, New York, and Florida. 71% of those undocumented immigrants from Mexico, Central America, 13% from Asia, 6% from South America, and others from all over the world. And just as a point of statistical interest, among the rest are approximately 50,000 undocumented Irish persons living in the United States. About 33 Irish were deported compared to nearly 177,000 Mexicans. So the first thing we need to notice about these statistics is that the majority of undocumented workers are brown-skinned people, and they are the largest group being deported. I think, and I can provide you with a lot of statistics that make a compelling case for how these undocumented workers currently benefit our society. They pay state and local taxes. I could tell you that of the 85,000 undocumented immigrants, if 85,000 undocumented immigrants were removed from Wisconsin, the state would lose about $2.6 billion in economic activity, $1.2 billion in gross state product, approximately 14,579 jobs. So there are a lot of compelling statistics about why it's important undocumented workers. But I wanted to try and understand the other side. And I wondered why immigration is seen as such a problem for those who argue for more restrictive and punitive immigration policy. So the arguments vary, but there's a quick summary of the concerns of those who want to strictly enforce immigration laws. And this is according to Dan Stein of the Federation for American Immigration Reform. He says that what the public wants is a stable population size, a healthy economy, and a sense of national cohesion based on shared values and a common language. That these three should be the components of a sound immigration policy. So I thought, you know, a sustainable population size and a healthy economy, those seem fairly reasonable. I can get behind that. But it's the last one, a sense of national cohesion based on shared values and a common language, that reveal the truth that lies behind these sensible goals. When you look more closely at that sentence, sense of national cohesion and shared values, I interpret those as code words for white, Christian, and English only. And it speaks to a deeper issue of xenophobia and racism. Now, as I said, and as you all know, immigration is an enormously complex problem. And at the risk of oversimplifying this very complex reality and borrowing these insights from my Unitarian Universalist colleagues, Reverend Kendall Gibbon and Reverend Mike Moran, I want to offer three counterarguments for your reflection, three flaws in the current immigration system. Laws that produce untold human suffering that is completely unnecessary. So the first great flaw, perhaps the essential flaw from which all other flaws derive, is the way current law fails to allow or account for temporary workers. There are hundreds of thousands of seasonal and temporary workers who come to the U.S. for jobs that few native citizens want, but which for many immigrants are real prosperity. These workers are an essential part of our economy, and all of us rely upon them. However, by severely limiting the number and type of workers allowed to enter the country legally, workers that companies and the economy need, the current system makes it inevitable that workers without documentation will immigrate to seek these jobs, and that employers will circumvent the law in order to hire them. Second major flaw is that we don't adequately recognize families on either end of the system. The process by which families might come here to work legally is arcane and backlogged to the point of absurdity. Decades in many cases. It forces spouses and parents to separate from their families for unspecified periods of time and actually prohibits visiting, since the migrant worker can't leave the country without losing their visa, and their families often can't enter. On the other hand, if someone's been living and working here, paying taxes, raising their family, even if they've been here for decades, they can risk deportation, even if they're married to a U.S. citizen. Even though our contradictory system makes it impossible for them to apply, they can be forcibly separated from their families and forcibly deported. It is a catch-22 for thousands of hardworking families. Which brings me to the third point, the third broken element of our existing policy, and that is the arbitrary, inhumane, random, and unjust ways in which enforcement takes place. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, use jails and detention centers, whether or not someone has committed a crime. Those in detention centers can be denied bond, deported without a hearing. The system is rampant with stories of how these non-criminals, tens of thousands of people, have been subjected to strip searching, shackling, solitary confinement, lack of access to telephones and legal resources, and verbal, physical, and even sexual abuse. This kind of enforcement completely fails to address the behind every one of these flaws to our current system, there's a story of a real human being. And I want to bring to your attention one such story that's unfolding in the basement of First Unitarian Society of Denver, Colorado, right now. First Unitarian Society of Denver is one that I have a personal connection to. I attended seminary in Denver. I was a student associated with that congregation. They hired me as their administrative secretary for a year, and then I was ordained by that congregation in 1993. So that congregation in that building is in my bones. And now it's serving as sanctuary for Jeanette Vizcuera. Jeanette entered this country illegally from Mexico in 1997 with her husband. She has three children and an adult daughter with deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA status. She has been regularly employed those years. She's been an activist for immigrant and labor movements. She was an invited speaker at the First Unitarian Society. She had requested a stay of deportation, which was denied. And at that point, she decided to take sanctuary in a makeshift bedroom in the basement of the First Unitarian Society of Denver. Vizcuera's case was determined to be an ICE enforcement policy in response to President Trump's executive order last month, which extended the scope of enforcement to include those with minor offenses or no conviction at all. The First Unitarian Society of Denver has joined over 400 congregations across the country who are offering sanctuary to undocumented residents of their community who are facing deportation. And I'm really proud of the First Unitarian congregation. This is not the first time they've done this. But while I was reading the article, I made the mistake of reading the comments in the section posted below a Washington Post article about First Unitarian and Vizcuera. One comment in particular is an example of the long thread of comments that represent the opinions of those who not only represent or oppose sanctuary, but oppose a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants with no criminal record to remain in this country. This particular person wrote, quote, "This is a very simple situation. Laws cannot be selectively chosen to obey or break. This person is an undocumented immigrant. That is a term the left invented to portray these people as if all they need are documents, all without following the proper channels to obtain them. This woman is an illegal alien who broke the immigration laws of the United States and must be deported." Now, I'm a person who respects the law, but I also know that laws are never as easy to interpret or enforce as some would claim. Nobody knows better than the lawyers and judges among us that the law is open to interpretation, it is influenced by precedent legal decisions, and it is always framed by what the Constitution says and larger ethical conversations about how do we best create the common good. Everyone at all points on the political spectrum agrees that our current framework of laws around immigration is broken and needs to be changed. Of course, however, examining the current legal framework for immigration invites us to answer the larger question of what benefits a culture. Cultural divisions among us rear their heads as fiscal conservatives claim that immigrants are a drain on the economy, and social conservatives worry about immigrants changing the culture of the United States in ways that sound an awful lot like the desire for white hegemony. Liberals deny that there is any drain on economics and flat out reject the belief that somehow the culture that immigrants bring to this country diminishes. The bigger question is, and who is we? What opponents to immigration reform seem to miss is that most Americans have become accustomed to appropriating other foods, customs, cultures when it suits their needs and wants. Yet some still insist that the workforce that brought these cultural assets among us stay in their own country. My colleague, the Reverend Jay Leach, put it this way. He emerging mobile capital and an immobile workforce. How does one morally defend a system that says if you already have resources, you are free to make money anywhere in the world, but if you are just a worker, you are confined to your own national borders? Do we think globally? Do we act globally? Do we do our ethics globally? I mean, let's face it. We enjoy huevos rancheros for breakfast, Chinese takeout for lunch, Thai food for dinner. We're grateful to have strawberries in February and to find a great deal on that leather jacket from Marshalls made in Vietnam or the Philippines or Honduras. Our shoes are made in China. Our linens from India. Our rugs created by the small fingers of children in Pakistan. So the current immigration crisis is not just about the migrant worker in the dairy farm in Wisconsin or picking almonds in California. It's much bigger and more complex than the simple response, she's breaking the law, deport her now. We must not confuse what is moral with what is legal, for they are not the same things. I mean, consider the fact that the forced removal of Native Americans from their land and onto reservations was legal. The capture and importation of and slavery of African people was once legal. The internment of Japanese Americans during World War II was legal. It takes moral force to confront and change laws which are morally bankrupt and should be declared illegal. So at this year's annual meeting, the governing board will place on the agenda a recommendation that this fellowship become a sanctuary congregation. And even though your executive team brought this to the board, this movement was not instigated by your ministers, but by you, by members of this congregation who have been writing. When the story broke about First Unitarian, I received an email that said, "What are we going to do about this? What are we going to do about this?" And another that said, "We say we're supposed to lead in social justice. How are we going to do that?" In a mission statement, actually in the mission statement work that I spoke of last week and that you all did in January, many of you in your comments referred to this fellowship as your sanctuary, a refuge, a place for you to gain strength for your journey, to be held and supported and nurtured and challenged and loved all at the same time, without fear of deportation back to the church of your childhood, or a purely secular life. You literally built a sanctuary here, this very room in which you now sit, a place of beauty where your moral core is given fuel and your spirit renewed. If this congregation decides to take this action, we do risk relinquishing a piece of our private sanctuary by extending hospitality to someone whose very life and family and livelihood is at risk. Your leadership understands that taking a stand as sanctuary would be a big leap for the congregation, but we have some time to talk together about its implications, and then we'll move to a decision at the annual meeting. And regardless of where the vote lands on June 5th, those who are leading this effort believe that this conversation is vitally important and it must take place now. And this is an opportunity for each of you to reflect on what sanctuary means for you as we walk together, sharing the sanctuary of the heart that we have found in this place, and imagining what providing a real, tangible sanctuary